owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. When you think about the iconic fighter planes of World War II, there's lots to come to mind, but probably my favorite, certainly, and one of the favorites across the country is the P-51 Mustang. It's probably one of the most iconic fighter planes of its history. It was designed to fulfill a specific mission, to be faster and more nimble than anything the Luftwaffe could throw up in the air. But it also had to do one other thing. It had to have enough fuel to fly and take the fight to the heart of Germany. The sleek and deadly Mustang turned the tide of the air war in Europe. But what you may not know is it almost didn't come off the assembly line. The story of the Mustang's evolution and the pilots that flew her into combat is the subject of a great new book titled Wings of War, the World War II Fighter Plane That Saved the Allies and the Believers Who Made It Fly. It's written by husband and wife team David and Margaret White. They're joining us today. David, Margaret, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you so much, Ben. Thank you for having us.
It's good to be on the show.
Margaret, let's start with you. Why this book 79 years later?
Yeah, well, actually, the genesis of the book was my dad, who at 103 is still with us. He was a ground officer with the 20th Fighter Group in England. And when I was a little girl, he told me stories of how the Allies were losing the war over Germany. And when the Mustang arrived, this little airplane turned everything around. And so with that in my mind, I decided 5 or so years ago that we should pursue it. My husband is a writer. He's written about the Navy for the most part, and I thought maybe we would venture into aviation this time, and that's how it began.
Well, in fairness to David, technically the Mustang is an airship, right?
Yes, so that's right. Yes,
that's right.
David, I think you've got two other books that are Navy-based. What are those books titled?
Those books are titled Bitter Ocean, The Battle of the Atlantic, 1939 to 1945, and True Bearing, which is a novel about an oil tanker spill. I began life as a journalist for the New York Times, and the Times assigned me to cover the waterfront of New York Harbor and shipping. And it sparked a lifelong love of the sea, and everything I've written is about the sea and ships until Margaret came along and told me about her dad's stories of the pilots and their exploits, and I said, we've got to do a book on it.
Well, I'm sure glad you did, because I really enjoyed it. And right off the bat, you introduce the book talking about some of the earliest period in aeronautical development. And it seems perfectly natural for us, for mankind, to say, I want to fly, so you look at the animals that can fly and try and figure out how they do it. But I found it interesting, you also reference in the book, David, to a guy who was looking at fish. And if you look at the P-51 in profile, it literally almost matches the profile of a trout.
Yes, Sir George Cayley was an Englishman, and in the 19th century, he was actually the first to have a man fly on a glider. It wasn't until the Wright brothers in 1903 that manned flight was first adventured, but Sir George Cayley, in one of his gliders, had his chauffeur fly in it, and that was the first flight of any type of man. And Cayley was fascinated by aerodynamics and fascinated by the fact that birds and fish swam or flew through their media so easily. And in studying fish and birds, he cut cross sections of a trout and studied their shape and took measurements on them. And these measurements led to his early experimentation with wings. And he did a lot of work on wings, and Cayley essentially settled the form of modern wings in his work. So Cayley had the basic design for wings early on in the 19th century, and it had come from his study of trouts and fish and birds.
I find that fascinating, because I never thought of it that way, and then I'm literally looking, I read that paragraph in your book, and then I turn back to the cover, and I see the P-51, and it matches perfectly. Now, Margaret, this was the blame for this book all falls on your shoulders, apparently, is what I'm hearing. And I tell you, if I was going to write a history book that required me to go to lots of museums and do lots of research and travel around the country and do personal interviews and all that stuff, I think I would choose to do so right in the middle of a global pandemic.
Yeah, well, that was in fact the big problem. We signed our contract just as COVID was beginning, and we had very little time to do any travel at all before we had to shut down and stay in our New York apartment. But we did get to California, where David was able to interview a number of pilots as well as bomber crewmen. And we did get to archives in Washington and in Boston. And so we were able to do a fair amount of work before we had to cocoon in our apartment. I would say that the nicest thing that happened is that a number of people stepped forward to send us materials from archives that were officially closed, and family members of the people that we write about also sent us personal correspondence. So we ended up with plenty of material, but at first it was kind of a daunting prospect.
Our first difficulty was that the Air Force archives in Montgomery, Alabama were closed due to COVID. And we looked at each other and said, now what are we going to do? How are we going to write this book without the Air Force Archive? And we found an organization called the National Museum of the Mighty 8th Air Force, which had copious material on action reports and combat reports and all sorts of analyses and military documents. And we worked out a way for the librarian there, who was terribly generous and very nice, to send us e-documents. We could ask for combat reports from the first raid on Berlin, March 6, 1944, and Vivian Rogers Price at the National Museum of the Mighty 8th Air Force would send us e-documents. So that really saved us.
That's amazing. Now, let me ask you this, because I later on we'll talk about my affinity for the 4th Fighter Group. Are there any of those pilots still around?
On my last book, on the Battle of the Atlantic, in World War II, I had no trouble finding Navy veterans who had participated in it. I had a wealth of interviews. On this book, we found only 4 pilots living, and we're lucky to get them. We found 4 pilots living and 2 bomber pilots, and we were lucky to find them. Sadly, between the time we interviewed them and the book came out, 2 of these men died. General Charles E. McGee, who was with the famed Tuskegee Airmen, the famed Black Fighter Group. General McGee died about 3 months after I had interviewed him. A bomber navigator named J. Clifford Moose died a couple of months after I had interviewed him. And a man named Mort Harris, Major Mort Harris, who had been shot down twice in his bomber and had a ditch in the Baltic Sea. Mort died not long after I interviewed him. So we were very lucky to get to those that we did, and indeed it was very hard finding survivors.
Yeah, I sympathize with that. Whenever we get a World War II or a Korean era veteran, they move right to the top of the guest list. In fact, I've got 2 of them I found that are coming on early next month, so we're definitely looking forward to that. Margaret, Dave, when we come back, I'd like to have you introduce us to a fellow. I don't know if he's the father of the P-51 or maybe the godfather of the P-51, but his name is Tommy Hitchcock. More with David and Margaret White when we come back, ladies and gentlemen. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're chatting with David White and Margaret White. They're a writing couple, I guess, a couple of authors that happen to be married that produced just a great book that just came out called Wings of War, the World War II fighter plane that saved the Allies and the believers who made it fly. One of those believers, and I don't know, David or Margaret, which one he wants to introduce us to, Tommy Hitchcock. I don't know if he could be classified as the father of the P-51, but certainly, without Tommy Hitchcock, this would have been an awfully short story.
Certainly the godfather of the P-51. Tommy was an interesting character. He had been born into a family of New York socialites, but that was really not his interest in life at all. He became, to start with, the greatest polo player probably that the world had ever seen in the 20s and 30s, and then went on to become an investment banker. But all that time, his mind was really on flying. He had left school at 17 to fly in World War I in Europe, and he never forgot it. So when World War II came along, he was determined to get in as a pilot again, and was told over and over by the Air Force that he was just too old. He was by then 40. Talked his way into a job at the American Embassy in London as an air attaché. He arrived at about the time that the P-51 had been delivered to the British and was being tested by the RAF, and the British had realized that it was a fabulous little airplane and that it could be even better with a powerful Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. And Tommy got behind this airplane and began to explore producing it in the U.S., discovered very quickly that he was going to have problems, that there was a lot of prejudice against a plane that had been built for the British. And so he just launched a full-bore campaign to win people over, both in the 8th Air Force in England and at the Pentagon, which took, a year and a half of traveling back and forth. But he was the one who was really responsible for overcoming all the resistance to manufacturing this plane.
And I tell you, in the book, it becomes very clear. I mean, Tommy was fighting the bureaucracy as ferociously as the P-51 would end up fighting the Germans in the air over Europe. And an amazing story. Now, David, let's back up a little bit and talk about the need, because I've often heard or read references to something called the Bomber Mafia. And that was the U.S. leadership that believed that these heavily armed bombers, the B-24s and the B-17s, could prosecute the air war without the need for fighter cover. But it became pretty apparent, right, that was a pipe dream.
In 1943, in the autumn, a few people really get the fact that the USA was really losing World War II, and it looked as though it might really go all the way and be lost. The navies were at sea and could only fight their sea battles. There was no land war until D-Day in 1944, so the land armies were useless. And the only punch that the Allies had were aircraft and the air weapon. And in the fall of 1943, American bombers were being shot down like crazy. Some of the raids had 75% loss rates. And you just can't fight a war with that kind of attrition and those kinds of losses. The reason they were being shot down was that they were unprotected by fighter escorts. You mentioned the Bomber Mafia, and the Bomber Mafia was absolutely at the center of this. And it was centered around the Air Force Chief Henry H. Hap Arnold, the head of the 8th Air Force, which was the Air Force in Europe, General Iris C. Acker, and the head of all European Air Forces, General Carl Tui Spots. These three guys led the clique of generals who believed that bombers were invincible and could take care of themselves with their 12 machine guns and an interlocking fortress formation in the sky, and they really scoffed at the need for fighters. And, of course, by October 1943, it was just clear that they weren't right, and the bombers were just going to keep being shot down at a terrible rate. And in 1944, the first Mustangs came online, and the Mustangs performed a remarkable feat of arms. They defeated the Luftwaffe, and they opened the way for D-Day, and they opened the successful bombing campaigns of that period in the war, and the reason was they had such magnificent range. Spitfire, British Spitfire, could fly only 345 miles. Mustangs could fly over 2,000 miles, and they could get anywhere in Germany. So that when the Mustangs took the bombers in, and the Luftwaffe pounced on the bomber formations, and P-51s were there to fight them off. As soon as the P-51s hit in March 1944, the 4th Fighter Group, which you mentioned, had 160 kills compared to 120 over all the previous year. So that was one sign of the immediate effect that the P-51s had in Europe.
I love just looking at history, how innovation comes out of desperation. And, you know, one of the keys with the Mustang was the drop tanks, the wing tanks, that extended its range. But I did not know this, and I learned from your book that the British, God bless them, they were actually manufacturing those tanks out of paper mache.
Exactly right, yes.
They didn't have any aluminum.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
I tell you, I want to come back to talk to Margaret a little bit about how the plane almost didn't make it to the war front. And it wasn't just one surprising thing I learned from your book we get the pride issue and the jingoism, if you will, but I don't accept it, but I understand it back in those days, but also just the complete corruption that almost ruined this aircraft. And so we're about to take another break, so I don't want to get into that right now. But I've had a number of World War II bomber crew members on the show, and Ben gets a dumb question every show, and so I asked one off the air. I said, what with all those machine guns up there and those tight box formations and planes, enemy planes zipping in and out so fast, how did you keep from, you know, stitching up the bomber below you or next to you with your own gunfire? Because I always found that amazing, and the answer was, well, we didn't. Friendly fire was always a real issue. So when we come back, I want to talk about that. Now, just clarification. So the original Mustangs were manufactured in the U.S. and then shipped over to Britain to be tested?
Yes, they all were.
That's right.
Okay. And that's when somebody came up with the idea, because the Rolls-Royce engine really is what took that fighter to what she needed to be.
That's right. The British realized that it needed that very powerful engine, and then the Rolls-Royce was made under license in the U.S. So it was not always made in England for the Mustang.
And at the end of the day, how many Mustangs were produced by the end of the war?
About 15,000.
Wow. Okay. That seems like an awful lot, but probably they could have used a couple more. Well,
yeah.
When we come back, Margaret, I'd like you to tell us about my least favorite character in your book, Major General Bennett Myers, and how he almost scuttled this whole project. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm talking with David and Margaret White. They've got a great book out. You can find it on Amazon. It's called Wings of War. It's a story of the P-51. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Listen, if you're a fan of World War II history, particularly the air war, I would highly encourage you to read Wings of War, the World War II fighter plane that saved the Allies and the believers who made it fly. It's written by husband and wife team David and Margaret White, who are joining us here on American Warrior Radio today. Margaret, I consider myself pretty well educated about World War II history, but I had never heard of this fellow Major General Bennett Myers. What a stain on the entire U.S. military.
It was. Benny Myers was the number two at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, which was the arm of the Air Force that ordered airplanes as well as other arms during the war. And Benny was a very efficient general and did a very good job of administering that department. But, in fact, he had a little business on the side out at Wright Field. It was called Aviation Electric. It was a little company that he owned that made small airplane parts. And he was doing deals with the major aviation companies where if they would buy his parts, they would get a contract for their airplane. I mean, this involved many of the famous aircraft companies that were making planes during the war. And he got away with this for quite a while. The only major aircraft company that wouldn't buy his parts was North American, which made the Mustang. And North American, as we know, did not get a contract for the P-51 until very far into the war. So what we believe is that there is a one-to-one relationship there between the head of North American's failure to pay off Benny Myers and his failure to get a contract for his airplane.
In your research, did you find, did Tommy Hitchcock, was he aware of that at the time?
We don't think so, no.
Okay.
We don't think so. And we don't necessarily think that General Arnold, who was running the Air Force, was aware of it either. There were several times during the war when the Air Force, it looked like became suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
But they were never able to prove anything. And it was not until 1945, in connection with another corruption case, that Myers was caught.
Myers was pretty secretive. He had his company, Aviation Electric, owned on paper by his secretary and his secretary's husband, so that nobody could trace this stuff back to him. And there were many other instances where he was pretty underhanded and pretty careful about his covert doings.
But eventually he was drummed out of the service.
That's right. He, was involved in commissioning a number of airplanes, some of which never flew. I mean, for example, the F-111, which was Howard Hughes' plane, was never even manufactured, although the Air Force paid out millions of dollars for that plane. And it was in connection with that case that Myers' records were examined by the Air Force, and it was finally discovered that he was doing this, and he was court-martialed and went to jail.
Yeah, but that Tommy Hitchcock was not giving up. What was the breaking point? I mean, which dam finally broke that allowed
them? Yeah, there were several dams. Tommy decided in late 1942 that he wasn't getting anywhere with the 8th Air Force in England, and he had to go to Washington. And so he flew over and began to crisscross the country between the Pentagon and Wright Field and California, talking to anyone he could about the strengths of the Mustang. And among other people, he saw FDR. And convinced him that this plane should be ordered. And so several hundred planes were ordered. But even then, the Air Force didn't get behind it. And so although the order existed, the planes were not being manufactured in any large numbers. But in 1943, January of 1943, of course, at the great conference in Casablanca, the meeting between Roosevelt and Churchill, the planning for D-Day began in earnest. And everyone knew that that would involve an air campaign over Germany, that the Luftwaffe had to be decimated in order for the troops to come up on the Normandy beaches. When that bombing campaign began in earnest in the summer and fall of 1943, and we suffered the kinds of casualties that David was talking about, that was when General Arnold realized that he had to have escort, and they began manufacturing the P-51 in very large numbers. They ramped up very, very quickly.
There was one landmark raid in October of 1943 over a German city called Schweinfurt and a ball bearing factory. And the 8th Air Force had been losing tons of bombers all the way, but the Schweinfurt raid was particularly devastating. 60 bombers were shot down, I think, out of about 700 that were sent, which was a devastating loss, and the loss in men was even greater. And after the second Schweinfurt raid, the 8th Air Force just essentially went on lockdown and didn't fly for months and months and months, and they had to really face the fact that the air war wasn't getting anywhere, and that the lack of fighter protection was the real reason. And that's when Tommy Hitchcock and his campaign came into gear.
David, coming back to the Trout reference, the one thing special about the Mustang was it had a sort of an innovative wing design, didn't it?
Yeah. There were six major innovations in the P-51A Mustang that really broke through barriers of engineering and development. The first was, as you say, the laminar flow wing, which had a particularly pronounced bulge on the wing, which tremendously increased lift. The bulge meant that the air on top of the wing had to travel faster than the air under the wing, and this created lift, which vastly improved the maneuverability and performance of the plane. The fuselage of the P-51 Mustang was also a revolutionary design. It echoed George Cayley's Trout experimentations by basing the design of the fuselage on cross sections of a cone, so that they were more natural. This was called second degree curves, and Ed Schmoued, who designed the Mustang on a fast track in 102 days with only 12 men, Ed Schmoued was the first one to use second degree curves in designing the fuselage of the B-51 Mustang. It had a bubble canopy, which was much better for looking around and spotting other planes. The steel was exceptionally thin, and there were a lot of other major developments of the Mustang that made it the best propeller-powered aircraft out of the war.
And what at that point, what was its maximum speed, and how did that compare to some of the other fighters? I mean, not, you know, leaving out the ME-262. Was it really the fastest plane in the air at the time?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. It could do 427 miles an hour. And I think the German Focke-Wulf, which was the best German fighter, could do 406. So that's a pretty significant difference. The Mustang could also turn better. It could dive better, it could climb better, and it was faster. So the P-51 did two things. First of all, it outperformed all the German aircraft, which we hadn't been able to do with the Focke-Wulf. And secondly, it enabled the bombers to get right in and pound Germany.
And I would argue, despite the maneuverability of the plane, that was probably the key thing that I think made it successful, just as an amateur historian. David and Martin, when we come back, we're going to introduce our listeners to some of the men who flew the Mustang. And Tommy was the advocate, the godfather, but when this plane hit the airfields in Britain, there was some other advocates that stepped up and started carrying the torch. I want to chat about that when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back after these brief messages. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with David and Margaret White. They've got a great new book out called Wings of War, the World War II fighter plane that saved the Allies and the believers who made it fly. Margaret, I shared with your husband, I don't know if he passed it on to you, but when I was a junior in high school, I was a very small town, and like every kid in the country, I was assigned a book report. And I went in there and I pulled a book off the shelf called 1,000 Destroyed by Grover Cleveland Hall.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
That started my lifetime love of World War II history, and particularly some of these characters. And I was so pleased to see these names pop up again in your book. Don Blakeslee, Don Gentile, and, of course, probably my all-time favorite, Kid Hoffer. But let's talk about Don Blakeslee, because he's then the one that took this this advocacy of the Mustang forward from what Tommy Hitchcock had achieved so far, right?
Well, first of all, I'm fascinated that you liked that book, because it was central to our ability to write the third section of the book about Don Blakeslee. It's an absolutely wonderful memoir, and it's one of two memoirs that talks about him. Don Blakeslee was probably the greatest ace of the war. He certainly flew more missions than any other fighter pilot. He had been flying in England since before we actually got into the war. He was flying in what were called the Eagle Squadrons, which were squadrons of young Americans who wanted to get into the war and couldn't get in yet. And so they began by flying for the Royal Canadian Air Force. So Don was already over there and had flown a huge number of missions by the end of 1941 when we got in, and had an awful lot of experience in fighters. And so he was assigned to be the first pilot to fly a P-51 when it arrived in England at the end of 1943, and was assigned to lead the first group, American group, that that took the P-51 up. And from then on, he was with the 4th Fighter Group, and that was because the Eagle Squadrons were subsumed into the 4th Fighter Group, which was the first 8th Air Force group that was formed.
And he fell in love with this aircraft right away, and I found it also fascinating when they delivered the aircraft, and his commander said, well, how long is it going to take you to train pilots? Because they were switching over from Thunderbolts, as I recall. And
That's right.
The P-47. And Don said, I'll have them trained in 24 hours. So many of these pilots, I mean, they had combat experience in other planes, but they learned how to fly the P-51 literally on the way to the target that day.
That's exactly right, and that was the deal he had to make with General Kepner, who had assigned the P-51 to the 9th Air Force for tactical work. The Air Force did not believe still that this was meant to be an escort fighter, and so it went first to the 9th, and it was Don Blakeslee who had to talk him into switching all the P-51s to the 8th. But in order to get him to do that, he had to say, listen, I realize these boys normally have about 200 hours on a new aircraft, but we're going to do it in 24 hours.
Now, David, I mentioned how much I love Kid Hoffer, the last of the goofball pilots, maybe, just a unique story there. But in some ways, the men that flew the Mustangs had to be kind of Mustangs themselves. And you've got a quote in your book, Joe Peterburz, if I pronounce that right, of the 20th Fighter Group. He says, I'm 19 years old. They gave me a plane with 2,000 horsepower, 650 caliber machine guns, and said to go have fun. I had fun. But Joe also had an encounter with an ME-262, and which was the German jet fighter, completely. I mean, some of the advances the Germans made towards the end of the war there were pretty darn amazing. Tell us the story about Joe's encounter with that ME-262 and the amazing letter he received 53 years later.
Joe was a fascinating guy. He was in a seminary studying to be a priest when he heard about Pearl Harbor, and he left the seminary at once and went and joined the U.S. Army and was assigned to the U.S. Army Air Forces, and he became a fighter pilot in Mustangs, and his greatest battle was the one that you mentioned, flying against a German ace named Walter Schuck, Shook had over 200 victories, and of course Joe didn't know that it was Shook that day. He just knew that there was a jet that tore through the bomber formation, just shooting down bombers as he went. Joe got on his tail and dove about 4 miles down in the sky, gunning at Shook, and finally got Shook, who disappeared into a cloud. Joe peeled off, and a couple of minutes later was attacked by a German aircraft, and Joe himself was shot down later that same day. He parachuted out of his plane, was injured parachuting down, injured in one leg, and he spent the rest of the war, he spent a certain amount of time in a German POW camp. He escaped from the POW camp and made his way to the forest until he ran into scouts for an American patrol. And he was overjoyed, and he was reunited with the Americans and back in action again. He went back to England, and I think he continued to fly with the 20th Fighter Group.
I want you to add that a little boy who had seen Peter Burr's P-51 shot down was able to excavate it in a field after the war, and through German records, he discovered that Peter Burr's had indeed shot down Walter Shook, who was a great German ace, and he brought them together, and they remained friends until Shook died for many years after the war.
That's amazing. I love that. I love that part of the story. Now, yeah. Would you say, and let me ask you the question of both of you, because we've got about 4 minutes left here. I mentioned just some of the technology, the ME-262, had to be very frightening to see that in the air. You know, they've got the buzz bombs, the V-1, the V-2, the Germany. I mean, they literally had developed something very similar to what is now the B-1 bomber. But would you say, well, one other factor was going on. So here's my question. At the end of the war there, I mean, Germany was basically sending kids up like lambs to the slaughter. But
they were.
Despite that, would you say the P-51 versus ME-262 is a statement to it's not the plane, it's the pilot?
Well, yes, except that the Mustang could actually outturn the ME-262. So while it was not as fast, it could actually outmaneuver those jets.
Mm-hmm.
And in diving, the P-51 was so fast that it could often keep up with these jets and even overtake them on a dive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Hitchcock, he kind of a sad ending. He himself died in a crash of his beloved plane trying to solve an issue. But where is he buried? Do you know?
He's buried in England.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Buried near where he died.
Would you say that was felt throughout the Army Air Corps when that accident killed him? I mean, did it cause any ripples, or were at war and people die?
Well, he certainly was celebrated in the press after he died.
The New York Times had his obituary on page one.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let me just wrap up. We've got just a couple of minutes left. I want to let you all close, but probably one of my favorite stories in your book, Orville Wright, one of the famous Wright brothers. You describe how he was on a commercial flight the day after the war was over, and take it from there, Margaret. Tell us about that interaction.
Well, that's my favorite story in the book. Orville and Wilbur Wright took off from Kitty Hawk in 1903. Everybody knows the story. They stayed in the air for a minute or two, but they made history as first in flight. And then they went on to make their flyer in Europe. And a few years later, sadly, Wilbur died of typhoid fever. But Orville lived on in the family house in Dayton, receiving accolades from people all over the world for what he and his brother had accomplished. Well, after World War II was over, he was asked to speak in another city, and he found himself coming home on an Eastern Airlines commercial flight. So he's at this point, well into his 60s. And they land the flight, and the flight attendant says, did you enjoy the flight? And he said, yes, I enjoyed the flight. And she says to him, having no idea who he was it your first flight, sir? And he says, no, ma'am, it wasn't my first flight, but that was a good flight, too.
Yeah, with a twinkle in his eye. David and Margaret White, thank you so much for joining us on American Warrior Radio. I encourage you folks to get a copy of Wings of War and read it. You can find this podcast and over 500 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We also stream on your favorite podcast platform. You can find us there. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to spend some time with you today. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
Listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 300 episodes of this program via AmericanWarriorRadio.com or the most recent episodes via your favorite podcast app.